you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Rashad Robinson, a civil rights leader and nonprofit executive who serves as the executive director currently of Color of Change. Under Robinson's leadership, Color of Change was ranked 6th on Fast Company's list of the 50 most innovative companies in the world back in 2015. From 2010 to 2014, Robinson was selected personally as one of the Root 100, a list of emerging and influential African Americans under the age of 45. He's made numerous media appearances in a variety of outlets. His writings and op-eds have appeared in The Guardian, New York Times, Huffington Post, and many other publications. Color of Change, the group that Robinson leads, is the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Driven by over 1 million members, Color of Change builds power for black folks and black communities, helping to move decision makers in corporations and government to create a more humane and less hostile world for black people and for all people. Under Rashad's leadership, Color of Change has developed winning strategies to change both the written and unwritten rules of key sectors of society affecting black folks' lives in Silicon Valley, in Hollywood, Washington, Wall Street, and Capitol Hills across the country. Today, we're going to be talking about Color of Change's current campaigns to increase access to and better representation of black and brown peoples in Hollywood, both in television and film, and how that connects to their broader work for racial justice in America. So today I'm going to be talking to Rashad Robinson of Color of Change. We're going to talk about some of the work that they have done in the area of racial justice historically and their most recent campaign, which is looking at representations of black and brown folks in Hollywood and also access to opportunities within Hollywood, both the film studio system and television. The day that we recorded the interview was the day of the Academy Awards, which of course in some ways was a great year for artists of color. Lots of nominations, both in the acting categories and also in the behind-the-scenes creative categories, directing and writing, etc. And so clearly, just 2 years after the hashtag OscarsSoWhite campaign went viral, there has been some real movement in terms of the Academy recognizing the artistic genius of black and brown performers, and yet there's still a lot to be done. And so Rashad and I are going to talk about what are those things that we need to have happen that will truly allow all of this creative genius to flourish within Hollywood, both in television and movies. So we'll talk a little bit about that. I wanted in my setup for the show today to discuss this issue and frame it in the context of my own perceptions and perspective on why representation and imagery like that, which is created within the realm of entertainment, is so important. I think sometimes those of us who are members of dominant social groups maybe don't pay enough attention to this, because if you're white, you know, you're represented pretty much throughout the culture. Images are really important, what we see and what we don't see. The images that young people in particular imbibe, not just within film and television, but within picture books, just within the culture generally, can have a significant effect, which is why it's important for image makers, which, you know, people in Hollywood certainly are, to think very critically about the images that they present. And I think rather than sort of blowing that off or downplaying the importance of it, those of us who are white, those of us who are men, those of us who are straight, those of us who are able-bodied, whenever you're a member of a dominant group, it really pays to spend some time thinking about all the stuff that you take for granted, all the symbolic images that affect your consciousness that you don't even think about. And I started thinking about this several years ago, and I'm gonna tell a story now that I'm sure some of the listeners, some of you have heard. If you've heard me speak, I've told this story many times in talks. I also talk about it in my book, White Like Me, my memoir. But I think it bears repeating here, and I assume that most of the people listening to this will not know the story. But several years back, we have two teenage daughters. I should start out by saying they're 16 and 14 now. But when they were 7 and 5. My wife and I and our two kids were sitting around on a sort of lazy Sunday afternoon. It was raining. And so we really were bored. We didn't really have anything to do outside. Couldn't go to the park. The kids didn't want to play any games that we had in the house. So we're all sort of sitting around bored, and we're flipping around on the television the pay-per-view movies on demand on the cable thing, right? And looking to see if there's any movie that we could watch that would be, you know, both age-appropriate for them and not too mind-numbingly horrible for my wife and myself. So we're flipping around. We come to the trailer for the movie Evan Almighty, which you may recall was, you know, comedy with Steve Carell as a congressman or a senator, one or the other, who is told by God, or as he is known in the Screen Actors Guild, Morgan Freeman, that a flood is coming and he should build an ark, you know, and ride it out. So it's sort of the modern comedic retelling of the Noah and the Ark story. As it turned out, the kids and my wife had seen Evan Almighty in the theater several months earlier. And it wasn't like it was so great they wanted to see it again, but because the kids recognized the trailer, recognized the characters on the screen, it got their attention. And Rachel, who was 5 at the time, looks up, sees Morgan Freeman in the role of God, looks at me and says, "Daddy, is that really God?" And I thought it was cute. Of course, I'm thinking in the back of my head, look, if Morgan Freeman is God, it's definitely not this Morgan Freeman. It's the Shawshank Redemption Morgan Freeman, not the Evan Almighty Morgan Freeman. But that would be way over her head, and that would be a movie she wasn't quite ready to watch yet. So I let that drop. But I thought it was cute. And so I tell her, yeah, it's Morgan Freeman. You know, he's an actor. He's just playing God, you know. And I thought that was the end of the conversation. But it was not to be, because now the 7-year-old's attention has been piqued, and she looks up, sees Morgan Freeman in the role of God, sort of laughs to herself, looks at her sister, and says in the dismissive and very confident manner of a 7-year-old child, "Rachel, that can't be God." And I knew in that moment two things, right? As clearly as I knew my own name. One was that I was going to have to ask her why not. And two, that I already knew what her answer was going to be before I ever asked her the question. Now, I did, let me tell you, I did for like a nanosecond go to this place in my head where I could fantasize that I was going to ask her, why can't that be God? And she was going to say, well, you know, Daddy, that can't be God because God is a woman. That would have been cool. Or that she would give me some existential answer like, oh, Father, what is God anyway, right? But, you know, she was 7, so I wasn't going to get that shit out of her yet. But I knew I had to ask, and I looked over at my wife, who was sitting sort of to my left, and I'm looking for any kind of moral support that I can get. I'm getting absolutely nothing except a look that says, yeah, Chief, I think this is your area of expertise. Good damn luck with this. I'm going to sit here, maybe take some pictures, scrapbook this precious moment. I don't know. What the hell? And so I'm sitting there sort of on my own, right? And I look at her and I say to her, why? Why can't that be God? And without missing a beat, with no sense of irony or misgiving, she looks at me and she says, well, that can't be God because God isn't black. God is white. Now, I want you to understand a couple of things about our family. Number one is we don't have any representations of God in our home, which would have given her that impression. We did not allow, for instance, any of those terrible children's Bible story books into our house. You know the ones I'm talking about that are so common that represent Adam and Eve as if they lived in the Garden of Sweden. We didn't have any of that shit. We didn't have any of the images of God as some white man living in the clouds and all these biblical figures as if they had lived in Europe. You know, we didn't have any of that. I didn't want that in the house. We didn't have that in the house. So we don't have any of those images. But I realized in that moment that even though we did not have those images in our home, that doesn't mean that children don't imbibe that symbolism elsewhere, right? Because when those kids go to church, as they did at that time, they haven't been in several years, but when they would go to the church that they were attending, the Episcopal church, and they look up at the stained glass, which is beautiful, right? It certainly draws your eye to it. What do you see? You see these images of biblical characters that are white. And even if you don't have any of those children's books in your home, you know, you go to the bookstore or you go to the library and you see those books, they're there, they're on the shelf, they're sitting on tables at the library, you see them. At Christmas time, we get cards sent to us by friends and relatives. You know, baby Jesus is on the cards in the manger looking like he might as well have been born in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania or some shit, right? I mean, you get these images of this whitened Jesus and whitened God. You know, the most ubiquitous image of Jesus that has ever been produced is Warner Salmon's Head of Christ, which has been reproduced like 40 bajillion times or something, right? It's the profile shot of Jesus with the, you know, sort of sandy, dirty blonde hair and blue eyes and high cheekbones and, you know, European facial features. Kids see that. And I realized in that moment a couple of things, right? It doesn't matter what you do in your home. Children are always picking up images for good or for bad. And so in the case of my child, she is seeing those images and it is creating in her a sense that, even if it's at a subconscious level, that she is closer to divinity or the creative energy of the universe, however you define that, than, let's say, you know, her black and brown friends who she was in school with. Or for a black kid, they're seeing the same imagery. And unless there is a very deliberate attempt to push back on that symbolism, then that kid is doing what? They are internalizing the opposite. They're internalizing the idea that they are in some sense further away from divinity or the creative source of the universe, however defined. And so the idea that images don't really matter or that they don't affect us is patently absurd, right? They clearly do. And so when you have images, whether it's in books or movies or television or churches or whatever it is, that affect the young person's consciousness in this or any other culture, it's really critical, number one, that we understand how that process is working and that we see it in our children, in ourselves. And then secondly, that we consciously attempt to push back on that. And I'm certainly not saying, you know, that Evan Almighty is this great social intervention because they pictured God as black. I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that any attempt to sort of challenge the assumptions of the society is valuable. It does get children thinking. Now, as it turned out, you know, my daughter and I had to have a long conversation later on that night. We had a conversation about it. And it was very interesting. You know, I was able to walk her through a process that was really inquisitive, right? So I'm putting her to bed that night and we're talking about it. And I said, well, why did you say that? Why did you say that God wasn't black, that God was white? And, you know, she said, what every kid, I don't know, you know. And I said, well, let's talk about it. So I said, as far as you know, what's the story of God? What did God do, right? And she said, well, God created everybody, created everything. I said, okay, so God created people, right? She said, yeah. I said, okay, so where were the first people? And she said, well, first people were in Africa. I said, right. So first people are in Africa. God creates people. What do people in Africa look like? And she said, well, they're black, right? I said, yes, exactly. So let's review, please. God creates people. First people are in Africa. Africans are black. Now, here's a little bit of a trick question. You may not know the answer to this, but I want you to think about it. In whose image did God create people? And she thought about it for a second, and she said, in the image of God, because she'd probably heard that at some point, right? Again, we don't do a lot of theology in our home, and I'm pretty militantly agnostic myself, but I'm just playing along here just to do this sort of Socratic method with my seven-year-old. She goes, in the image of God. I said, very good, Ashton. Now, let's review one more time. As you just said, God created people. First people are in Africa. Africans are black. And, as you just said, they're made in the image of God. So, question to you, what color is God? And she got this big look on her face, you know, her eyes got real big. And she said, I don't know, maybe God is black. I said, very good. Time to go to bed. I'll see you in the morning. And I tucked her in and we were done. Now, look, I'm agnostic. I don't want my kid to necessarily have any kind of anthropocentric notion of what God looks like. I think that's an absurdity personally. But on the level of race, right, having her think through this process where she's starting to wonder, like, why did she think that in the first place? And what are the other possibilities was important. And literally 6 to 8 weeks later, I remember her coming down to breakfast one day. We hadn't talked about it again in several months. She comes down and she says, God, Daddy, do you really think that God could be black. I said, I don't know. What do you think? She goes, I don't know. I guess so. I'm like, very good. Have some Cheerios or whatever, right? So it sticks with them, right? The conversations we have and the ones that we don't have. The images that we allow and the images that we counter are very important. And so if kids are picking up all these images of good and bad, of divine and evil, of superior and inferior, of normal and abnormal throughout the culture, it's very important that image creators like those in Hollywood, like those who do children's picture books, like parents as teachers to our children, think critically about how those images affect us, because it's not a benign process. Kids are always soaking things in for good or for bad. And if we're not interrogating that imagery, if we're not thinking critically about the way that a young mind is interpreting some of that problematic imagery, then we're not ready for the way that our kids are internalizing either their own sense of superiority or their own sense of potential inferiority. And we can't afford to be unclear on that. So we're going to talk today about that. I just wanted to frame the conversation with it. We're going to get into that a little bit more with Rashad Robinson, Color of Change, in just a second when we come back. Stick with us. Well, first off, Rashad, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. Lots of things that obviously we can talk about. Before we get into some of the things that you're currently involved in at Color of Change, talk a little bit for listeners who don't know the history of the organization. I can't imagine there will be many people like that listening to the show, but you never know. So let folks know sort of a brief rundown of the history of some of the work that you all have done over the years and the issues that you work on.
Absolutely. So over 12 years ago, really in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, which was a flood that was caused by bad decision makers that turned into a life-altering disaster. While Black folks were literally on their roofs begging for the government to do something and really being left to die, a number of activists, particularly James Rucker, our first executive director, and Van Jones, they came together and really felt like there needed to be an engine and a vehicle. Because at the heart of Katrina wasn't the issues that everyone knew about, whether it was geographic segregation or generational poverty or the impacts of issues with our criminal justice system and the way that structural racism undergirds all of that. At the heart of Katrina was no one was nervous about disappointing Black people. The government wasn't nervous, corporations weren't nervous, media wasn't nervous. And so we were formed as a new infrastructure to channel the energy of everyday people when they're seeing something outraged and upset, using the latest technology to really translate that energy, that presence, into the power to actually change the rules. And so we do that through taking on strategic campaigns every single day, whether it was early campaigns to fight for the Gina 6 and really mobilize hundreds of thousands of people to stand up for those young men who were being railroaded down in Gina, Louisiana, around a schoolyard fight and being pushed into felony convictions, or whether it was the work to force Glenn Beck, Pat Buchanan, and Bill O'Reilly off the air through mobilizing our members to take on advertisers and push advertisers to have to make a choice. These are all representations of the type of energy that Color of Change builds when moments are happening and the way that we give everyday people the ability to take strategic action.
Yeah, no, I think that's so critical because, you know, as I was thinking about the impact that you all have had, it struck me that one of the key things about Color of Change is that it does give the ability for people who maybe are never going to be the kind of folks who are going to spill into the streets for a protest. Because, you know, lots of folks just won't be that person. That's not who they are. But they want to do something. And they may be dispositionally not the kind of folks who are going to go to a big demonstration or a big rally. But you all provide an opportunity for them to take action, to make those calls, to send those letters, to sign those petitions, to mobilize in concert with others and have an impact. And I feel like, you know, 30 years ago, if someone said, oh, you know, sign this petition or write this letter, it maybe wouldn't have had much of an impact because we didn't have the volume that social media allows. We didn't have the economy of scale that you all are able to tap into. But this is an example of how it's an interesting marriage, if you will, of modern activism, that is to say, using social media and a lot of different mechanisms we haven't always had, but it's also old school in the sense that boycotts are some of the oldest civil rights strategies. So, you know, does that seem like a good take on this, that this is a way of connecting people that maybe otherwise feel left out?
Absolutely. That's an excellent way to say it. And I think what we really learn and what we try to really build on from what we've learned from past generations is the strategy behind it. Not just thinking that a petition alone will solve something, right? A petition in and of itself is just a bunch of signatures on a piece of paper. But a petition as a strategic tool at the right time, targeted at the right person with the right sort of theory of change behind it, can make a difference. So you'll never see a petition from Color of Change that says, Paul Ryan, please stand up for affirmative action. That's not going to do anything. Now, figuring out maybe who are Paul Ryan's top donors, yeah, and are any of them like deeply invested in needing Black consumers. Right. Now we might be talking about sort of a strategy that could move a decision maker or an actor in the political space to have to do the right thing. And so the petition and the tools and the technology are one piece that allows us to bring things to scale and bring it quickly to scale. But without a strategy or a theory of change or sort of a power analysis, yeah, behind it, it's all just a bunch of noise.
Well, you know, speaking of that, in the modern era, obviously it is impossible to create a more racially just society unless we address the power and the influence of popular culture. It's such a leading indicator of where we are, and it exerts such influence on us, whether it's advertising to the entertainment industry. Tonight, as we are speaking, is, of course, the 90th Annual Academy Awards. Lots of great films and great artists competing for Oscars tonight, including several Black creative geniuses, Jordan Peele, Daniel Kaluuya, Denzel Washington, Mary J. Blige, Octavia Spencer, Dee Reese, and Virgil Williams, who wrote Mudbound. You have Strong Island in the documentary category with Yance Ford, the director, on that. So there's some incredible Black talent represented this evening as we're speaking. I know you all have right now something called the Hollywood Culture Project at Color of Change, which is aimed specifically at improving both the access and the representation of people of color in Hollywood. Talk a little bit about that, and specifically in the context of these last couple of years, because it's only been 2 years since the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite went viral because of the way in which Black artistic genius was really shut out of the Academy Awards that year. I guess some would say, and I want you to address this too, I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a second. Given the fact that there are so many Black folks who are represented this year at the Oscars, I'm sure there would be some who would say, well, why do we need to keep talking about this? It seems like, you know, quote unquote, problem solved. Why is the Hollywood Culture Project so important in spite of the representation we see this evening at the Academy Awards?
The project is so important because we're not looking for like 1 year of change or 1 year of celebration. This is a problem that has existed in paid corporate creative jobs and opportunities for generations. And so 1 year of the Academy Award or 2 years of the Academy Award recognizing Black talent doesn't change the fact that there are tons of structural problems inside of Hollywood and inside of the studio system that really creates barriers. And so sometimes these years of successes are still anomalies. And Ava DuVernay recently, the creative genius behind Selma and Wrinkle in Time, which will be coming out on Friday, this coming Friday, March 9th. Ava DuVernay just recently, you know, listed off like a number of the Black directors from Dee Reese to Jordan Peele and a couple others and said, like, if you can name all of them, then it's still a problem. It's still an anomaly. Presence alone isn't power. Power is the ability to change the rules. Sometimes those are the written rules, sometimes are the unwritten rules. And so what we are looking for is to how do we get to scalable solutions? So through the Hollywood Culture Project, we're doing a lot to both amplify great things. We're doing a lot to push back against problems inside the studio system and really hold folks' feet to the fire. And then we're doing real work around trying to report on where the problem currently is. And so we produced an incredible report with UCLA, Darnell Hunt at UCLA, on the diversity in writers' rooms. And we didn't just look at the diversity of the 234 shows on the air. We tracked it back to content on the air. And one quick thing I'll say to you, Tim, one quick anecdote that always surprises people. There are 9 crime procedure shows that were on air during the last season. They're the shows that sort of oftentimes go into cities, the Law and Order type shows. Yeah. Out of those 9 shows, only one of those shows had more than one Black writer. And then you look at the content that appears on air from those shows and then how that content is educating a generation of jurors who are going to go in and make decisions about people's lives, educating a generation of voters who will be voting about whether they think the criminal justice system is fair, and whose experiences are held up, whose experiences are not. And so what comes out of Hollywood has a tremendous ability to shape not just sort of people's lived experiences in their community from a cultural perspective, but actually what public policies get advanced or don't get advanced.
Well, what are some of the obstacles that you can think of and talk to the audience here about in, let's say, the Hollywood studio system, whether it's with regard particularly for writers, directors, cinematographers, because some of that quote unquote behind the scenes stuff is where so many of the obstacles appear. We've had, you know, American audiences have been accustomed to Black performers, not always rewarding them as they should be, but at least seeing them for some time. But from the creative side, the back end side, the writing, production, the cinematography, so often shut out. The reason I'm asking you this question is I feel like we have this impression of Hollywood, right, as this very quote unquote liberal place. And I don't know what that means when people use that term. I suppose it means that, I don't know, they vote Democrat mostly, all right, whatever. But this is a good, I think, opportunity to explain the difference between perhaps overt old school racism that people think about, where it's, you know, somebody in the studio that's just like, oh, I hate Black people. You know, it may very well not be that, but there are these systemic and structural obstacles, institutional obstacles that I think sometimes folks don't always see. What are some of those that you've discovered, like, for instance, with the study you all did with UCLA, that we need to be thinking about?
So it's a couple of things. It's been a lot of conversation around diversity in Silicon Valley. And a lot of people talk about the lack of diversity as related to, you know, this startup culture where people have an idea and then they hire their friends around them to sort of work with them, and their friends look like them. And that oftentimes, right, starts at the top with the venture capitalist model of who gets invested in, whose idea to believe, who's trusted with money. And that similarly relates to Hollywood in a different way, in a more surprising way, in an industry that is actually so old. It starts at the top with who gets the green light, who trusts talent with moving an idea. But each of these shows, when they start up, are almost like little startups, because a showrunner will get greenlit for a show and they will have an idea. And so they will hire the writers that worked with them on the last two shows, or the people that they trust or have a language with. And without any sort of structural avenues for other people to get in, what happens is it becomes this like self-fulfilling prophecy where folks kind of go out and find people that they're comfortable with, because that's the model, and it keeps, you know, replicating itself over and over again. And many folks in Hollywood get into the business because they want to create the things that they saw as a child. They want to recreate the things that inspired them. And so we end up having a glut of largely sort of white men who have decision-making authority and then bring people around them that they feel comfortable with, which can obviously oftentimes be white men or other white people, and give them the opportunity to create because they trust them with the resources. And that continues itself. The studios over the years have tried to do things, and the networks have tried to do things like create diversity projects, which almost have on their face looked interesting and possibly like a successful tool, but in fact have really worked against. So the network will hire someone to go in as a writer and put them on a show. But because they weren't actually hired by the showrunner, they actually are hired by the network. They don't come out of the budget of the show. They come out of the network's budget. What ends up happening is after their like 1 year ends up, the show doesn't hire them on because they can get another Black or brown person cheaper the next season without having to pay for them. And so those folks end up not actually getting to stay on the shows, which means they never develop seniority, which means they never get enough credits to be able to greenlight a show. Right. What we know is that when Black folks who do get to break through, they hire other Black people. They hire other people of color. Their writers' rooms and their cinematographers and their directors are, of course, the most diverse. A couple of great examples is Mara Brackett-Keogh, the creator of Girlfriends, who actually wrote the foreword for our writer's report. She is one of the Black women who've been able to break through and have a number of different shows, from Girlfriends to Being Mary Jane to The Game. She hired on her show Kenya Barris and gave him an opportunity to rise up through the ranks. And now he has a TV show on the air called Blackish. Mm-hmm. And he has a number of Black writers inside of his writer's room. Shonda Rhimes, you know, has hired many different creatives, Black creatives and Black writers and directors. But Ava DuVernay, famously talks about after she won the Critics Award at Sundance for The Middle of Nowhere, couldn't get a job as a director anywhere until Shonda Rhimes hired her to direct an episode of Scandal. And so these are examples of when you have so few folks of color with decision-making authority, what ends up happening is that people of color don't get to break through. And so the industry has to do things like actual new structural rules. Because like you said, Hollywood gets a lot of credit for being very liberal. And even tonight, we'll see all sorts of speeches on the stage of, you know, bashing Donald Trump or talking about diversity, when we know Hollywood has a deep problem. And we can only kind of, I kind of sum up the deep problem by saying that America had a black president before America had a black superhero in a major movie. Right. So black kids got to see a black man in the Oval Office before they got to see a black man saving the universe. And that's an example of like how Hollywood is just not as liberal as they would like to believe.
Well, and I think it's important for people, I think sometimes white folks in particular, you know, and of course I know all white people because, you know, I've been white a long time, but I think we sometimes don't think about the importance of seeing, as a black kid, seeing black characters in various types of roles, whether it's a superhero role or just the head of a company in a movie or the president or someone who's just, got a functional family or whatever the hell, like the multidimensional ways that people actually are in the real world. And part of the reason we don't think about how important that is that we're so used to seeing ourselves represented in this complex way that we don't really get how other folks don't. I mean, I remember growing up when I would go to movies, whether it was Indiana Jones or whether it was, you know, the geek in a John Hughes film, I could always find somebody that I could identify with. It was very easy. I could find myself in characters for good and for bad. I could see myself. And I gather that we don't understand that that's not always been possible and still is not always possible for kids of color. Why is it so important for young black kids and teens and even adults, for that matter, to be able to see on the screen, whether it's TV or whether it's film?
Well, it's hard to dream of something that you can't see. For young people who oftentimes don't see diverse characters or don't see diverse characters with intention or backstories. It's such a real problem in terms of what people sort of believe about the world. And because of our lack of clear representations, it creates oftentimes very false images. And there's been a number of studies of black and brown kids about themselves and who they are in the world. It creates really deep challenges for decision makers. And I'm not just talking about decision makers like, you know, politicians. I'm talking about someone who's making a decision about whether or not to rent someone a room, or someone in a hospital deciding whether or not someone deserves the benefit of the doubt in some extra treatment, or can, you know, take pain a certain way. There are all sorts of examples and studies that really show that the representations in media have a tremendous impact, not just on how people see themselves, but how the world sees them. And as a result, their ability to live a life that isn't harmful and hostile. You know, one of the initiatives that we're actually working on right now, which is really exciting, is Give a Child the Universe. It's giveachildtheuniverse.com. And we worked to get a $10 ticket for The Wrinkle in Time. And what we're doing is people around the country are buying tickets by going to giveachildtheuniverse.com. And they're buying $10 tickets. And we're distributing those tickets to community groups in cities around the country. And, you know, in Birmingham, in Compton, in Harlem, in D.C., in Philly, all around the country, we're distributing these tickets to folks, young kids who wouldn't get to see a young black girl saving the universe, and trying to create as many opportunities for these type of films and these type of stories to reach people in ways that give them the same type of story that so many white kids get to have about the type of characters that inspired them.
Well, and I think one of the things you mentioned a second ago about the impact that this has on everyday interactions, and you mentioned hospitals and in the medical profession, where we know from the research, for instance, there is this tendency to underprescribe certain pain meds for black patients. And in part, that there are really a couple things behind that. Of course, one is there's this stereotype about, you know, this idea that, oh, they're going to become addicted to these things because we have certain drug-related stereotypes. But it's also about this perception that black folks, I guess, have some higher pain threshold, you know, that they can just just take more pain, which is also a horrible assumption to make. And I think in part that also stems, if you think about the imagery, even the quote unquote positive imagery of black folks in Hollywood, one of the old archetypes, right, has always been this sort of strong black person, right? Who you know, maybe, and it's, you know, been referred to as the magical Negro who comes and saves white people, or it's always someone who seems to be able to rise above. And in a sense, that is intended, I gather, by the people who've put that forward to be a positive image. It's not a pathological character. It's not a dysfunctional character, but that also is not multidimensional, right? It's like saying, well, you're just strong and therefore you can take anything, which is not helpful any more than having the person be entirely weak, right?
Yeah, well, it's a story. It's a story without any background or any intention, right? Why is that person strong? What made them strong? White characters get so much narrative around their character that allows you to understand who they become and why they're that way. And so the fact of the matter is that what we are really trying to push for in Hollywood is not all of just characters that are all quote unquote positive, but stories that have, that are fully formed, right? I would take more Fruitvale Stations over a whole lot of other, you know, movies out there. Fruitvale Station, right? For instance, Ryan Coogler's movie on Oscar Grant showed a complex, multidimensional character that creates humanity around an individual. And those are the type of stories that we want to push for, not just positive or negative, which is such a dichotomy that doesn't actually play itself out in the real world. Right. In so many ways, whether or not black people and people of color get the benefit of the doubt, are seen as fully human, are seen as deserving of empathy, all of those things are incredibly important and incredibly powerful in terms of the role that Hollywood has in making that possible or not possible. The way that the type of images that come into people's homes, from the news to the entertainment industry, the power of what people see and hear in the media is so important to how people get to how folks get to show up every single day. You know, we recognize that we're doing all this policy work, all this work to try to like shift policies or shift the practices at corporations or in different industries around the country. But at the same time, people go home each day and are being hit with images. And so, you know, an example of this is that we are doing a whole lot of work around criminal justice, working to elect new district attorneys or working to change bail reform. And we can get op-eds published. We can, you know, get new folks in office, but people go home and they watch those crime procedure shows and they understand the system to be working in a certain way. They see the hero law enforcement figure and the criminal black and brown man each week. And even when the police officer steps out of what they're supposed to be doing on one of those shows or acts irrationally, you're like, oh, but wait a second, their father doesn't really love them, or they lost their partner last season. Right. And so they're given so much humanity. And what we recognize is that those backstories, that humanity, who it's given to and who it's not, has a deep impact on how people are seen in their own lives.
Yeah, talk a little bit, now that you brought that issue up, about the justice system. I know one of the other things that Color of Change is involved in right now is working on issues of bail reform. Talk a little bit about that campaign, because I think it lines up very neatly with the work you're doing around Hollywood and representation, because the two things are so intimately connected. Talk a little bit about that work, what you all are involved in.
Yeah, it actually maps really great. You know, one of the things that we're doing around bail reform is both working at the local level around the country in states like California and New York and Maryland to pass measures that get us closer to ending money bail. You know, over 70% of people that are currently in jail haven't been convicted of anything. And we have a system in this country, a money bail system, that's really only the United States and Philippines in terms of world democracies has this type of system where you're really better off being guilty and rich than innocent and poor. Because, you know, people are arrested oftentimes in over-policed areas. They are set really high bails and they're given an opportunity to plea out. And people oftentimes have a choice. Either you plea or you pay this very high bail. If you can't pay the high bail, then you're behind bars. And if you're behind bars, you're losing access to your kids, education, your job, what have you. And what we've been working to do, based off of all the studies that we've seen, is really in this practice. And we've been doing it through the local work. We've been doing it through really researching the industry. A lot of times when we show up in some of these cities or states to move bail reform, what we end up seeing is folks who we think should be on our side, like in some places, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, lobbying against us. And we produced this big report where we really researched how the money was flowing from the bail industry into either groups around the country or to elected officials. And we found that it wasn't just the local bail bonds, or the local bail bonds associations, which are oftentimes local businesses, but it was the big insurance companies that back these local bail bonds that actually provide the resource infrastructure for them to issue bail. And the big insurance companies have actually created about a $2.3 billion industry, which really is moving money from poor communities, from people's grandmothers and their aunts and what have you, into the hands of big corporations. Even if you are released after going through the system and it being seen that the charges are dropped, you still owe the bail bonds folks a percentage of that money. You don't get all that money back. And so part of this system is really an exploitation of Black communities, and we're working to change that. One interesting Hollywood connect is that we did a lot of work on a TV show called 7 Seconds, which is just on the air right now. We worked behind the scenes in the writer's room and really tried to work with the writers. We gave them some tapes of local bail hearings so they could see that what you see on Law and Order, these writers could see what you see on Law and Order in terms of bail hearings is not actually how bail hearings go. 90% of cases never actually go to trial. And we gave them that as well as helping to connect, bring Marilyn Mosby from Baltimore into the writer's room to talk about what it meant to prosecute police officers as a Black woman DA. So connecting sort of the work we're doing on the ground into the Hollywood writer's room. So what people see in the media doesn't push back or contradict the type of policy change we're trying to push on the ground. In fact, what people are seeing in the media helps to create more energy and motivation behind it.
Absolutely. Well, it's almost like there's this closed loop. If you don't get into those writers' rooms and you don't have people in those rooms who know a little bit about that system, they're only going to represent what they already know about the system. That's going to come from prior media representations. That's going to come from very cursory research. And if they haven't been directly involved, let's say as Marilyn Mosby, in Baltimore, and people that have actually been involved as prosecutors who know a little something about how this system works, they're going to continue to represent it as this, ultimately fair system, ultimately uncomplicated system where the narrative arc is easy to do in an hour and it's not particularly complex. So I feel as though really what we're asking for is not simply flipping the script and having every show be about the horribleness of the system, but it's about showing that you can have a system where there are lots of moving parts, and some of the people involved in those moving parts have both better inclinations and worse inclinations. There are those people involved, let's say, on the prosecutorial side, who have a heart for the issue of equity, who see the problems in the system, but they're sometimes caught up in a criminal justice system that doesn't really encourage them to respond to their better angels, which is why who the DAs are around the country is so important. I know you all also work on those issues. Talk a little bit about that. Why is it important for us to not only work on the obviously stronger defense capabilities for people accused of crime, so many of whom disproportionately are low income and folks of color, but also making sure that the prosecutors, whether they are of color or white, have an understanding of these issues?
Well, 80% of DAs in this country run unopposed. And so that right off the bat, right, creates an incentive structure where these district attorneys don't feel beholden to the community. In fact, oftentimes they're beholden to the police officers, the fraternal order police, the folks that they're working directly with every single day, not the voting base, because the voting base doesn't have a choice. 90% of district attorneys in this country are white. And so we do not have reflective democracy in terms of these positions. There are 2,400 district attorneys around the country. They are the most powerful actors in the criminal justice space. They make executive level decisions every single day about whether or not someone gets a misdemeanor or a felony, how drugs are prosecuted, what money bail looks like, and they have huge offices and huge discretion. And so we felt through our political action committee that we could do nothing but get involved in these races, to mobilize our members and to engage them. And so we, leverage, you know, exciting technology through peer-to-peer text messaging and ask the members who are signing petitions and showing up to rallies and making phone calls around policing a criminal justice system to join us in an effort to start reforming who is their DA. And we cross-tabbed cell phone numbers with a voter file and had people show up to these text-a-thons in cities around the country with music and food and some political education in the room. And people were engaging voters in places like Houston and Philadelphia, Chicago, Orlando. And we've elected reform-minded district attorneys in partnership with our friends in the grassroots and really have started to see deep change. Philadelphia, the most recent DA that we helped to elect, is working to end money bail in that city, is no longer prosecuting low-level marijuana cases. And that has real impact on people's day-to-day lives, right? There's a whole lot of things we tell people and stories we tell people about voting. And sometimes the story's not always true. It's like, oh, if you elect that Democrat to the state legislator, they're going to like do everything to represent you. And yes, they may be a good person, but if they're not in the majority or on the right committee, they may have no real power to move anything. They may not be as bad as the other person, but that's not really aspirational. Yeah. District attorneys on day one can go into their office and actually make decisions that have deep impact on people's lives. And for us at Color of Change, the reason why we tell people to vote, the reason why we try to mobilize people to vote, is not because we want to put a certain party in power or a certain person in office. It's because through voting, we can potentially have the power to force the type of change that makes people's lives better. And in the spirit of trying to get people engaged civically, to get people engaged politically, improving their lived experiences and making folks have more power in their community is the reason why we do this work.
Well, that's what's, I think, so cool about Color of Change, in the sense that you're using a lot of new medium and a lot of new technology to really do a thing that is at the heart of what community organizing has always been about at the local grassroots door-to-door level, which is doing campaigns, biting off campaigns that are both huge but also winnable. Like these are winnable campaigns. You're thinking of strategically ways to launch efforts that have a really good chance of succeeding. And the importance of that, for people who don't come out of an organizing tradition, you might not know that, but for those of us who do, we know that the key to organizing is always picking off some battles early on in particular that can win, so that the people you're mobilizing can get a sense of what their power is. If you pick off a battle that says, you know, Color of Change, we're starting a campaign to end white supremacy. Okay.
That
sounds like a great plan, or to end poverty in our time. And, you know, no organizer would ever disagree with that goal, but no organizer would lead a community or work with a community for that goal. You want to have smaller, digestible and winnable pieces, because once you start getting some victories, and you all have scored several over the years, it allows people to say, all right, this is real. Like, we actually have more power than we believe, and we have more power than just going to the polls and voting. As important as that is, that's a once a year, once every two, once every four, once every six, whatever the race might be. But there's all this other stuff that we can be doing that will have an effect. And I don't think I can stress enough why that model is so critical right now.
It's so critical in this era where people are looking for something to do and looking to engage and don't just want to be loud. Right? They just don't want to be loud. And that is really how we try to think about the world, is that every single day we're hit with all sorts of information, from the radio to the television to the newspaper and the internet. And if people are not given something real to do in that moment, they go back to doing what they were doing before. Right. And so much of how we think about it is through this theory of respond, build, pivot, and scale. So respond to a moment that happens in the world. Build energy. Then find those systemic pivots and then scale that participation over time. And so, you know, when people were mobilized around voting rights and Trayvon and trying to figure out what to do, and we found the systemic pivot around ALEC and forced over 100 corporations to divest, leaving them with a $1.5 million budget shortfall, but also forcing them to stop working on issues like discriminatory voter ID and stand your ground laws. Or going after the groups that actually help fund white supremacist groups, and they were household names, right? Right after the election, we started building a campaign to really focus on the rise of white nationalist groups. And we were doing a lot of research and talking to our friends at the Southern Poverty Law Center and other places. But what ended up happening was we went on these sites and we saw that, wow, you can go on these sites and just enter your Amex card or your MasterCard, and you can buy paraphernalia, that T-shirts attacking black folks, or you could just give money to Richard Spencer so he could get a busload of folks to show up in your city. And we went to those credit card companies and tried to get them to divest, to say, we'll no longer allow our fees to be processed on these sites, just like we won't allow ISIS to process fees. And what ended up happening was these credit card companies gave us the runaround for like a couple of months, told us that we had to talk to the banks, told us that they were overly regulated. We built a web platform, really, that sort of was called No Blood Money, and started to having a conversation around blood money and the way that these companies, from PayPal to Amex to American Express, Discover. And when Charlottesville happened, we re-ramped up that campaign and started mobilizing our members and went back to these credit card companies who somehow no longer told us to go to the banks. Somehow the banks were no longer the problem. Started sending us lists of sites that they no longer were going to process fees on. So what's important here is that there was real infrastructure laid. In the moment, we weren't trying to do all the research about those credit card companies. We had done a lot of background and work. We had spent time on the phone with these companies going back and forth. And to PayPal's credit, they had been taking sites off for a while before some of the other sites. The same thing with companies like Eventbrite, which were allowing folks like Richard Spencer and Milo and others to use their platform to organize rallies and events. We had spent time with their CEO and others. But once Charlottesville happened, we were able to do that pivot. You leverage that pivot. And that's what I mean by presence to power. In that moment, people were looking for something strategic to do. They were sharing articles on Twitter. They were, ranting on Facebook. They were outraged. They were sad. They were frustrated that this could happen and that this could be happening, that the president of the United States, regardless of political party, could say that, there's two sides to this. But people didn't have something strategic to do. And that's what we try to do in those moments. And that's the organizing principle behind it. The technology and the tools, we just overlay that. And Julian Bond, and I'll say this, Julian Bond used to tell this great story. He told me this great story, the late Julian Bond, who one of the leaders of SNCC and the former chairman of the NAACP, of how SNCC installed the Watts line in their Shore University office. Watts was the precursor to the 1-800 number. It allowed you to call long distance and avoid the Ma Bell operators, because at the time, when you called long distance, you got transferred from operator to operator to operator until you got to your site. But the operators were largely controlled by the White Citizens Council in the South. And so a call from Howard University to Tuskegee could get intercepted, and the information about what students were working on would be shared with local authorities, the White Citizens Council, KKK, what have you. And so Watts allowed them to actually move their information much quicker. It allowed them to do it with bypassing gatekeepers. But the Watts line wasn't their theory of change, just like using Twitter isn't our theory of change. The Watts was a tool that allowed them to actually do their work and move it to scale and move it quickly. And so as long as we see the technology, as long as we see the platforms as tools, with a recognition that our opponents are going to be using them as well, with a recognition that inside of big corporations, they will never completely be our friend, and they will at the end always be tools of the state that will prevent us from having the type of true disruption and revolution. But in the moment, they have allowed us to democratize participation, bypass gatekeepers, and move information. And as long as we don't mistake what we're doing for what we need to continue to do down the line, or we don't see a victory that's a momentum achievement as something that's actually structurally changing something, then we're good. And that's what we try to really focus on, with being quite rigorous with our victories and quite vigorous with the type of campaigns that we take on.
Absolutely. Well, for folks who want to get in touch with Color of Change, get involved, whether it is in terms of connecting with your campaigns or making donations or spreading the word or whatever they can possibly do, what are some ways that they can do that?
appreciate that, Tim. You know, they can go to colorofchange.org, and right on the main page, they can join us. It's free to join and really free to engage in a lot of the campaign work. If you're someone who's looking at issues in your community and you want to figure out how you can think about launching your own campaign, you can go to Create a Campaign and learn more about our Organize For platform once you go to the main site, colorofchange.org. And if you're looking to find ways to send a young kid to go see Wrinkle in Time on March 9th, you can go to Give a Child the Universe, giveachildtheuniverse.com, and you can work with Color of Change to send a deserving child who might not otherwise get to see the movie to have an opportunity to sit in the theater, to imagine and to dream. And so there's a lot of different ways to join and to engage with Color of Change. But mostly in this era, our ability to not just be loud, but to take strategic action when possible and to join together with others is going to be the thing that helps us win.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.